You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 25th of April, 2024, on Monaco Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's programme, Poland's foreign minister lays out the country's future foreign policy direction, including plans for media broadcasts in Russian. After that,
if any serviceman, Filipino serviceman, is killed by an attack from any foreign power, then that is time to invoke the Mutual Defense Treaty.
The Philippines President Bongbong Marcos issues an ominous warning amid Chinese naval incursions during a U.S.-Philippine military exercise. After that, we'll get the latest business headlines. We'll hear how artificial intelligence can impact the future of work. And finally, it is Thursday, and we all know what that means. Good afternoon, Fernando.
Hello, Chris. For today's Global Countdown, we're heading for the very first time to Ireland.
Ireland. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. Poland's Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski has been speaking before his country's parliament this morning, offering an update on where the country's government sees its foreign policy priorities and also unveiling a new media gambit. The Polish broadcaster TVP World will begin broadcasting in Russian. Well, joining me now is Mateusz Mazini, writer-at-large at Gazeta Wyborcza and lecturer in journalism at Collegium Civitas in Warsaw. Mateusz, great to have you back on the show. Set up this speech for us, if you could, first of all. How big a deal was it going in?
Well, it was already a big deal yesterday when it was announced and sort of leaked to the press with its main priorities. The attendance among the MPs and the parliament wasn't particularly striking, but we have had the presence of President Andrzej Duda and all of the diplomatic representatives that are accredited to Poland. So it is every single time a big deal, especially after a change of government. And this was the first time Sikorski spoke and laid out his priorities for foreign policy ever since he returned to the office of the head of Ministry of Foreign Affairs last December. And I think he already set the stage for himself in the very first line of that speech, because he said at the very, very beginning, diplomacy is the first line of defense of Poland. And much of what he talked about was in different ways and different forms centered around issues concerning defense. He began by criticizing the former law and justice government quite heavily for destruction of public services, for politicization of the civil service inside diplomacy, for lack of skilled diplomats and people employed by the ministry. And he even said that restoring high quality civil service in Polish diplomatic outposts will take years, and it will be much tougher than restoring a positive image of Poland on the international scene. But he also laid out six major priorities for his tenure as foreign minister. And I think among the six, the two most important ones are the statement that Poland, and I quote, "Poland needs to develop its own defense mechanisms and instruments, not only within the space of traditional military, but also misinformation." He said that Poland is already being attacked by Russia on a regular basis through hybrid measures, misinformation, also through energy threats, and needs to be able to counter those threats on all possible levels, including a better cooperation with domestic opposition at home.
And what did Sikorski say? I mean, you mentioned the defense aspect, which is clearly related to, you know, to a degree to what's happening in Ukraine, the war there. But what did he say specifically about Ukraine? Relations between Poland and Ukraine are still somewhat tense, but Sikorski also spoke in Ukrainian, didn't he?
He did. And I think this is very much symbolic and will go down in history as a very powerful moment in Polish politics, that we have the Polish foreign minister who in Ukrainian inside the chamber of the Polish parliament pronounces that Lviv is part of Ukraine, Donetsk is part of Ukraine, and Crimea is part of Ukraine, in case anybody had any doubts. He devoted much of his speech to Ukraine, said that Poland will remain an ally both independently in bilateral relations and also as an advocate of the Ukrainian cause inside NATO and the European Union, but it will do that with the protection of its own interests as well, which is a thing, a very important statement, because many of the critics of both Sikorski and Donald Tusk accuse them of being sort of servants or even puppets of the West, especially Berlin and Brussels, and not protecting the Polish interests in a sufficient manner. So Sikorski said, we will defend the interests of Polish small farmers, agricultural producers, food producers, but let it be clear that the biggest threat both to Poland and the West, broadly speaking, remains Russia. And he spoke extensively also, I think that's fairly interesting in his personal context, about the gap between the needs and the capacity in production of defense and military hardware in Europe, and taking into consideration that he's widely rumored to perhaps become the first EU commissioner, should that post be eventually established after the June European Parliament elections. The fact that he speaks so much about the fact that Poland is exploring the possibility of joining the European anti-missile shield, that Poland, just like any other European country, needs to step up its defense production, signals that he has a vested personal interest in that role.
And Mateusz, just finally, what about this other aspect of his speech, this media move announcing the launch of a Russian language arm broadcast of Poland's public broadcaster? How significant is that?
Well, this might be major and might actually play out very well with the international audience, because TVP Word is the English-speaking branch of the Polish public TV, and it has been broadcasting mostly in English for the last 2 years. It was briefly suspended after the government takeover, government reshuffle in December, but right now it's broadcasting still 24 hours a day in English, in Ukrainian, and in German. And Sikorski mentioned that TVP Word will also from now on broadcast in English. There are unconfirmed rumors that it might evolve into an independent unit, a brand new TV channel that will be broadcasting into Russia in Russian. And Sikorski sort of flirted with a possible name for that channel, because at some point in his speech, he said that Poland will contribute to the efforts that Russia today will become Russia tomorrow. That's largely metaphorical, I believe, for the moment. But I think this is indicating the direction in which he wants to go. He even said that he increased employment in communication and media departments inside the foreign ministry. So misinformation is clearly a threat for him, but airing pro-Western propaganda into Russia and Belarus will definitely be something that he aims to focus on in the upcoming months, perhaps years.
Potentially look out for Russia tomorrow. Mateusz Mazzini, thank you very much for joining us. Now here's Sophie Monaghan-Coombs with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the United States and China need to manage their differences responsibly ahead of expected tough talks today. Blinken, the first US Secretary of State in 14 years to visit Shanghai, has not yet announced plans to meet President Xi Jinping. Palestinian hospital officials say Israeli airstrikes on the southern city of Rafah in the Gaza Strip killed at least 5 people today. More than half of the territory's population of 2.3 million have sought refuge in Rafah, where Israel has conducted near daily raids as it prepares for an offensive in the city. And Venice is implementing a €5 entry fee for day trippers on specific dates throughout 2024, starting from today, a public holiday in Italy. This trial initiative aims to alleviate the strain of mass tourism on the iconic canal city. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Sophie. Joint military exercises known as the Balikatan between the US, Philippines and other Western allies have been underway this week, as you heard on this show on Monday. But there has also been a response from China, which has flooded the region with its own Navy vessels. The Philippine Navy says some 124 Chinese vessels are currently in the West Philippine Sea. That's the portion of the South China Sea that is claimed by the Philippines. The question is how much this risks the escalation of an exercise into something resembling the real thing. Joining me now from Madrid is Gonzalo Vasquez, Center for Naval Thought, Spanish Naval War College. Gonzalo, thanks very much for coming on the program. Tell us, first of all, from your perspective, what the Balikatan military exercises are about.
Good morning. Well, the Balikatan is a joint military exercise between the US and the Philippines, and it is probably the most important one they have together. Since it first started back in the days of the Cold War, it has evolved from a small Navy-to-Navy drill to the premier annual military exercise held between both. In recent years, amid China's increasing assertiveness in the South China Sea region and Manila's reapproachment of relations with Washington since President Ferdinand Marcos took office in 2022, Balikatan has expanded both in size and scope. And this year is the first time that France is also participating, so it's a relevant iteration.
And so that's the one side of this, the military exercises. The other side, as I say, is the fact that China is watching this extremely closely, 124 Chinese vessels in the region. Why are we seeing such a dramatic rise in the number of Chinese vessels in the region? And what can we glean from, I guess, the kind of ships that China is sending? How big, how serious is their response?
Well, China's Coast Guard has been attacking Philippine supply boats near Second Thomas Shoal and other contested regions for a while now. And both the Coast Guard and the maritime militia play a key role in asserting China's illegal claims in the region. But this time is certainly out of the normal, as many people have said before. And I think the reason behind this is that China is simply not happy with the deployment. The drills are obviously not well received in Beijing, and this deployment they have conducted is the way they have to show their discontent. And we also know this, of course, because they have also expressed such discontent in their English language outlet, Global Times, in which they basically called the exercise a ridiculous stunt. So still, China's growing assertiveness in the West Philippine Sea and the responses is usually... Is the response they usually have against this kind of deployments, but you know, this time is certainly bigger than normal.
Well, and it bigger than normal, and as the Philippine president said, as we heard at the top, you know, he warned about the danger of an escalation, especially if any Filipinos are killed by China's actions here. Are we seeing an escalation of China's kind of hostile acts against the Filipinos in the West Philippine Sea? Is there really a danger of this escalating to the point of actual deaths?
Well, China's harassments have certainly grown over the past years. And, you know, China has by far the world's most expansive and aggressive maritime gray zone program. So I'd say there's an escalation on China's side, but for the moment, not on the side of the Philippines and their allies. And other countries in the region have also suffered this, such as Australia. But again, this behavior is not something new, and I don't think we're going to see that much of an escalation on the Philippine side, precisely because they usually try to approach this from a nonviolent perspective, just showing the world what China is doing and showing that what they do is illegal, but not engaging with them to the point in which this could escalate into a military conflict.
Is there, though, a point where that could change, I suppose? Or I just wonder if you get the sense that, you know, China here is testing the waters, is going further and further. At some point, perhaps the Philippines has to do something different, or at least the way the Philippine president mentioned, invoke its common defense treaty with the United States. Is that something that China might be worried about?
Well, I think they are certainly worried about that. And I think as long as Beijing continues behaving this way, the risk of a real escalation is always going to be there. But for the moment, I would say that this particular flare-up, I don't think they will lead to something more serious, precisely because I think because of the presence of the US and French vessels right now in the region, many people have said this. They don't think that China will go on to do anything illegal. But again, we never can tell in the future what may happen. But, you know, the risk is always there, and we have to be very careful with that.
Gonzalo Vasquez, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Chris Chermak. It's time now for the latest business news with Victoria Scholar, Head of Investment at Interactive Investor. Victoria, always good to have you on the show. We're going to start with something a little different today, the mining sector. There's a possibility of a major takeover there.
Yes, that's right. The Australian mining giant BHP has proposed an acquisition of its smaller rival Anglo American in what would be a $39 billion deal. So it would be one of the biggest mining deals we've seen for a number of years, bringing together two global mining giant in a major transaction. The offer represents a 14% premium to Anglo's closing share price yesterday. And that's why Anglo shares are up by more than 13% today, reflecting that offer price. But the deal depends on Anglo splitting off its South African platinum and iron ore units. And BHP is mainly interested in Anglo's copper resources. And the tie-up would give BHP about a 10% market share in global copper mining.
What is the significance of that in your mind? I mean, what's been happening in the mining sector that is leading to these kinds of takeovers? Is it an important issue right now for a lot of companies and countries?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that we haven't actually seen many major takeovers in the mining sector for quite a while. But what we've seen is that Anglo American shares have fallen about 10% over the past 12 months, partly because UK companies have been suffering from a lack of international investor confidence, the Brexit discount, and other factors. And so this makes it ripe for a takeover. And until now, a lot of suitors have been dissuaded by Anglo's complicated structure and its complex mix of commodities across various different subsectors of the market, including platinum and diamonds. So this is why this deal is getting so much attention, because it'd be a real shakeup and change in direction for the mining sector.
Well, let's move on to one other story, Victoria. Shares in Facebook's parent company, Meta, have slumped, not really for the first time, but in this case, after the company has flagged much higher spending this year than expected.
Yes, that's right. So the stock fell by more than 15% after hours, and it's poised to open lower in the US session at lunchtime. And that's actually despite the fact that it reported better than expected earnings and a 27% jump in revenue, which was the fastest rate of expansion we've seen since 2021. Investors were more focused and spooked by the fact that Facebook's parent company warned that expenses are going to be much higher this year as the social media giant invests heavily in artificial intelligence. It's expecting to spend between $35 and $40 billion, up from its previous estimate for between $30 and $37 billion. So that's why we've seen that the stock is down. But before this move, the stock was up about 40% already this year, and it tripled last year. So it's had a pretty good run.
This kind of spending, though, it does come on top of, you know, Meta itself and what it's been spending on the, you know, its own ideas. I just wonder how you get the sense that AI sort of fits into the spending that it's already doing.
Well, I think that for a lot of the tech sectors, what is dividing the winners from the losers at the moment is the ones who are really focused on artificial intelligence. So NVIDIA has been a standout stock market winner, for example, over the last year because of its heavy involvement in AI. Apple, as a contrast, hasn't really been too vocal about artificial intelligence, and it's struggled. So on the one hand, Meta really wants to signal the fact that it is very much invested and believes in AI. But at the same time, I think investors are a bit scared by how much it's planning to spend.
Victoria Scholar, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, if the pandemic has had a lasting effect on where we work around the world, city or country, office or home, the rise of AI will have a lasting effect on how we work. Put those two together and you have what Julia Hobsbawm calls the amazing age of opportunity, challenges and changes for workers of all industries. Well, I'm delighted to say that with me now in the studio is Julia Hobsbawm, columnist about the future of work and author of the new book, Working Assumptions, What We Thought We Knew Before COVID and Generative AI and What We Know Now. It's published today. Julia, good to have you here.
Hello, lovely to be here on Publication Day.
On Publication Day, we're celebrating Publication Day. So tell us a little bit about the book, but perhaps to start us off, it's interesting that working in this day and age for all of us doesn't feel like it's for the faint-hearted, is it? There's been a lot of changes compared to previous eras, and that's really what this book is about.
Yes, this book really says that we haven't had so much turbulence, disruption, opportunity or threat for 100 years since automation came in, since mass industrialisation of society, and work was part of that shift. And I'm a sort of pessimistic optimist. I think that there are lots of reasons to be cheerful, but there are also quite a few reasons to be fearful. And the really interesting thing that I also cover in the book is that we used to talk about work very delineated between the white collar worker and the blue collar worker. And actually, I'm not sure that demarcation holds. What I mean by that is, of course, there are differences in pay and inequality and treatment and so on and so forth. But the combination of COVID, technology, generational shifts means that really every worker feels the same. They feel, as you say, you know, not fabulous, not comfortable, not safe about the future of work. And that's what I'm trying to explore in the book.
How much of this is being led, I always kind of wonder, by what workers actually want, whether it's the blue collar or white collar worker, as opposed to sort of inevitable technological or pandemic induced change?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, there's definitely been a huge cultural shift, generationally led by the Zeds and the millennials, around moving from take your money to do the job, move on up, get high pay, get perks, and consume as a result, as your reward, to purpose-led work. And this is now causing quite a lot of problems. It means that the way organizations recruit and retain has got to promise purpose. And it means, as we've seen with Google last week firing 50 employees and Columbia University sending in the police for their own students, it means that when people take purpose into their own hands over, say, Israel-Gaza, it isn't quite such a comfortable, cuddly, cultural point anymore for employers. So this whole space is becoming pretty fraught, and nothing that was assumed about work, which is really why I've called my book Working Assumptions, is holding. In other words, one working assumption was everyone's going to go back to the office. Not so. Another working assumption is that the working culture of a place is positive and not fraught, etc.
Well, speaking of working assumptions, particularly, I wonder if you could talk about AI and how that is going to impact the workplace. Have we reached our working assumption? Like, do we know what is going to happen with AI at this point? Or where could this go? How are people starting to use it when it comes to things like ChatGPT? And do we have any real idea of how far this is going to change the workplace?
Well, it's a really interesting point. So first of all, I would say that the working assumptions we are making about AI and its impact on work and the workplace are a work in progress. That's obviously the case. If you think about the rapidity with which ChatGPT came into the world, i.e. out of the blue after COVID, even though it existed in large language models existed to the cognoscenti beforehand. So the speed and pace of change means whatever one assumes now is probably going to be incorrect. But one thing is absolutely true is that the workplace is now obsessed with the idea of both liberating its workers and upskilling through generative AI, which is positive, but also arguably outsourcing jobs to AI. And what worries me actually is the sort of, may I say, tech bro mindset, naming no names, Elon, is, you know, there is a sort of tech bro mindset that worries me, that says, look, it's great, we don't need to work, let's all have universal basic income. And I think that's not the right way to look at the issue. The right way to look at the issue is to say that the way we work and when we work and why we work and where we work is all up for human level improvements, irrespective of the technology that we're using. And this blind faith that AI is going to sort of wipe the slate clean of all that boring stuff, I think is a mistake. But AI is genuinely revolutionising the white-collar workplace as much as the blue-collar one. And that's obviously the working assumption was that it would always be blue-collars affected by tech. And now it's both.
One, I suppose if there is a positive from the way you're speaking, it is that it allows us maybe to look more at the purpose that we have in our work. But there are these two sides to it. And you describe this moment in the book as an inflection point. In which direction? You described yourself as a sort of optimist, but not so much necessarily. I mean, is there something different about this moment and whether AI in particular is going to have a positive or a negative effect?
Well, I think it's going to have positive and negative effects. I mean, you can already see the positive effects. There's a company called Upwage, which AI matches job opportunities and transparent pay rates across America for low paid shift workers in, say, hospitality. It actually allows people in far-flung places who might already be in the hustle culture doing a number of jobs to do interviews at a time of their choosing. So there are really positive steps that are being made to democratize work. But equally, it presents massive problems for skills because, you know, you might know what a ChatGPT prompt library is, but not every single one of your listeners does yet. You know, CVs are going to have AI skills on them. What are AI skills? Are they manual, like operating, you know, a lathe digitally, or are they intellectual in terms of understanding how to interrogate data and knowledge? So the world of work is getting a lot more complicated, but I am optimistic because people want change, the market is asking for change, and at change you can improve things. It's stasis you want to worry about.
Just finally, Julia, then, when you described the tech bros and sort of this idea that AI, you know, we all assume it's just going to work out. If it is not, whose responsibility is that in your mind? Is it up to us as workers to say where we want this to go, how we want to use AI, what's good and what's bad about it? Or is it up to governments or some other group to kind of dictate what the potential benefits are and, you know, ensure that it's sort of steering us in the right direction for where we want to go with the world of work?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, without doubt, regulation needs to be in the picture and is in the picture. My worry is that legislation is so slow. When you think about the rapidity of movement in the tech itself, and then you think of the slow lane, tortoise-like levels of policy changes, you actually need both. You are getting both. So the Trade Union Congress here in the UK called last week for a bill of AI to really look at the rights to privacy. You know, we're in a world called, summed up by one word now, datification. Right? Datification means that we're all data points. Well, we're not. We're all humans. And so that tension in individual workplaces as a worker and as a regulator is actually the same. Do we want control over our output or do we not? And so it's all up for grabs. But I do think that we are getting that change. We're embracing that change. And if you ask me in 5 years' time, will it be net positive? I really hope so.
Let's all hope so. Thank you very much, Julia Hobsbawm, for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally, on today's show, our senior correspondent and music curator, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is with me in the studio. It's back to our regular scheduled programming, Faye, after a couple of weeks of Global Countdown specials. And since you didn't do this at the top of the show, I'm going to do it to you. Jia Huich, Faye.
Thank you, Chris. I know very well what you did. You said hello in Gaelic, right?
I did. I apologize to any Irish listeners for completely, potentially butchering that.
But you know, you said the word special. I think this is a special one as well, because this is the first time that I'm doing Ireland for the Global Countdown. And you know what?
Which is why we have to celebrate with the Gaelic language.
We have to celebrate it. And don't worry, there will be an Irish artist in the charts.
Very good. You were kind of waiting for that, weren't you? You wanted this to be an interesting one with a little bit of a local flavor.
Absolutely. But accidentally, Chris, I discovered, if you look at the Irish charts, it's an example of what's happening in the charts worldwide. I sense something's happening in the music industry right now. And the number five song, which we're going to play in a bit, I feel that in the last 5 years, there's been a lot of electropop and a lot of kind of crazy costumes and everything. But now there's a little bit of a return to basics, those kind of balladeers, a little bit of folk pop.
More mellow.
Very mellow. And I think young people are kind of craving for that, because a lot of those artists, they're coming out of, you know, TikTok. And it's kind of surprising.
We need a bit of mellow in our life. Is that basically what this is about?
Almost dull in a way, but not in a bad way, because maybe we need dull sometimes.
We could all use a bit of dull sometimes.
Sorry, that actually sounds very bad. But at number five, we have the American singer Michael Markargi with Scared to Start. Don't you wait to try it? Are you scared to find it? And do you wait? It's a swaying song,
I feel.
And he plays golf as well. I mean, do you know what I mean? It's all very conventional. But I have to accept it's a
golfing singer. This is what we've come to, Faye.
A golfing youngster from, I believe, from Cincinnati.
A youngster who golfs as well. Like, this is, you think this is like the later generation, but okay, sure.
Number four, I mean, she's not really a balladeer, but I really like this track because it feels so honest. It's very breezy. Her name is Sabrina Carpenter. And one interesting thing about her, she came from Disney Channel. I mean, this channel, they created
so many
pop stars. I mean,
they have a history of this, exactly. Like, this is what they do.
Oh my God.
Churn them out.
Absolutely. And they're always very successful. And that's her first top 10 in the US, first top 5 in Ireland as well. Very important. This is Pure Sunshine. And number 4, Sabrina Carpenter, Espresso. Now he's thinking about me every night. Oh, isn't that sweet? I kiss so. Say you can't sleep, baby, I don't know. That's that me, espresso. Sort of
classic pop, but not so mellow.
Not so mellow. I wonder if she plays golf. Maybe not. By the way, I have nothing against golf, by the way. I should try at some point. But
I do. I'll say it.
You do it.
I'm a tennis player. But anyway,
Teach me after. Number 3, I think that we've been talking about this guy for ages. And again, he's part of that kind of folk pop melodic thing that I was talking to you about. And again, he's a young guy from the United States. I think there's a trend,
a US theme here, a certain trend.
Absolutely.
Young guys from the US.
It's Benson Boone with Beautiful Things. Let's have a listen once again. Please stay. I want you, I need you, oh God. Don't take these beautiful things that I've got. Please stay.
Faye, this is the third countdown that I've done with you where we've played this song, and we had a 2-week break with a special in between. I mean, it shows the lasting power of Benson Boone, doesn't it?
I mean, he's huge. And do you sense, I think he was playing the guitar as well. So guitar is back, because guitar kind of disappeared.
Rock is back.
Rock is back in a way, right? calm down there. But you know, it's Benson Boone. I'm not sure if I'm a fan, but people like it. Number two.
Tell us what you really think, Faye.
Sorry, I'm very... Oh my God, I don't know what's happening to me today. And number two, we have the English Cypriot producer, Artemas. And again, this song is viral worldwide. It's a little bit sexier and clubbier, if I may say. So no guitars, no mellow, no golf here. This is Artemas with I Like The Way You Kiss Me. I like the way you kiss me. I can tell you miss me. I can tell it this. Not trying to be romantic. I'll hit it from the back just so you don't get attached. I like the way you kiss me. I can tell you miss me. That's a cool song.
There is an interesting mix of styles in this top five, I will say.
Yes, and if you are interested to see Artemas live, he is performing in Berlin tonight, so there's still time.
Maybe just hop on a plane, people, if you're in Berlin, might be a little easier.
And I think tomorrow he's heading to Poland as well, so he's doing super well. And this song, as I said, it's viral.
This feels very German, if I may say, in like the sort of German techno dance kind of scene. So I can see this doing very, very well in Berlin.
It is indeed. But Chris, I think we reached the moment, right? The number one song in Ireland.
The moment.
This is it. It is a big moment because he's an Irish artist. And I was waiting.
Which I didn't actually know. I wouldn't have. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't realize that. So,
and
yes.
Talking about your country, Chris, he's huge in the United States, Hozier. I mean, of course, we all know Take Me to Church, which was his huge track, I believe, in 2013. Yeah, it's been a while.
Huge track. Always still played on the radio in the US.
But there's something about Hozier, and I've heard two anecdotes this week that really surprised me. Flynn, our sound engineer, he told me that his friend, she tattooed Hozier in her skin. And I have a friend of mine, she said she had sex dreams with Hozier. So there's something going on with Hozier. There's something going on there with him. Let's find out why. And number one, Hozier, Too Sweet. You're too sweet for me. I take my whiskey. My coffee black and my bed is green. You're too sweet for me. A presence there, right?
He definitely always has a presence. I'm still stuck on the sex dreams and how that fit into the song there, but you're too sweet for me, so I guess there's something there.
There's something there. And he's the first Irish artist since Sinead O'Connor to be number one in the US as well.
Amazing. Interesting.
A lot of fun stats.
Flashback to the past there.
Exactly.
As well. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining us. That is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Tom Webb. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Christy O'Grady. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.